deported after all. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You've probably seen Elin Ersson's video, the one that went viral last week, of her trying to prevent a man's deportation from Sweden by refusing to take her seat on a plane. Today we follow up on that. Ersson has since found out that the man she intended to help was deported to Afghanistan anyway.
It feels horrible because he has never been to Afghanistan before. He was not born there. And he has no possible way of knowing where to go and how to provide for himself in a country that he's never been to.
That story, plus the view of Paul Manafort's trial from Ukraine, and the story behind the music video, This Is Iraq. That's all ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Thank you for being with us this Wednesday, a day when Manafort, Russia, and 3D guns are some of the top stories on the news agenda. We'll get to all of those, but here at The World, you get stories from across the globe, looking at how other places deal with issues we're grappling with too, like immigration and deportation. In Sweden, you may have heard, even seen, the Swedish woman who delayed a plane in Gothenburg, Sweden. The plane was heading to Istanbul. The woman, an activist named Elin Ersson, refused to take her seat and faced down irate passengers. She was trying to stop an immigrant's deportation to Afghanistan, and she captured the moment on video on her phone.
And you're upsetting all the people down there.
What?
So I don't care what you think.
I'm just asking.
I'm just telling
what
you,
is
I don't
more
care.
Important, your
no,
life
no.
or the time?
What about all these children on here? You are frightening. Turn your phone off.
Don't take my phone.
Sir.
Thank you. So an English guy just got really angry and he stole my phone, but a flight attendant was really nice and took it back for me.
And here's how the tense standoff ended, with the Afghan man being taken off the plane.
They're taking his bags off, so the plane to go out.
The activist was hailed by many, even comparing her to Rosa Parks. But since that video went viral, some Swedish media began digging. And now some outlets are alleging that the 52-year-old Afghan deportee on the plane had been convicted of assault in Sweden. We haven't been able to confirm that allegation with Swedish authorities, but beyond the plane incident, this mirrors a larger story about immigration in Sweden today.
The even bigger context to all of this is the fact that there is an election coming up in Sweden in just over a month, and immigration and integration, two of the hottest topics here.
In a few minutes, more from that Swedish journalist. But first, let's hear from Elin Ersson, the activist from the plane video. She told us there was confusion on the plane that day. The Afghan immigrant on board was not the one she had intended to assist. She had originally wanted to help a 26-year-old immigrant, a man named Ismail Hawari.
I met his family at the airport, and I was talking to his sister a lot, and she was breaking apart. And she was telling me about how her mother wanted to protect her brother, and she was going to get her passport, and she was trying to have a ticket on the plane. So I was trying to make her feel like she didn't have to go on the plane. I just couldn't let this family be separated again and have their family member be sent to Afghanistan.
So you get on the plane, but it turns out Ismail was not on the plane. Instead, there was another immigrant who was seated in the back of the plane. What did you know about him?
I knew nothing. We had no information about him whatsoever.
So were you walking up and down the aisle of the plane looking for Ismail and not finding him?
Yeah, exactly. I walked up once or twice, and then I asked the flight attendants if he was on. And they told me that he wasn't, but they showed me the other man.
There's very little known about this man, this other immigrant, the 52-year-old who was on the plane. There are some media reports saying he served time for assault in Sweden, but the authorities in Sweden seem to be keeping the specifics out of the public view, and we can't corroborate that. If he was indeed charged with assault, does that put your protests on the plane in a different light?
I don't know anything about him yet, but it is my Swedish belief that the death penalty is not okay. It is also my belief that if you deport someone to Afghanistan, you can't make sure that they will be alive. And indirectly, Sweden is helping with the death penalty by sending people to Afghanistan.
Right, and that's the point you're making to the passengers on the plane in this video. There was another moment on the plane when a man pointed out to you that in a country there are rules, and one of the rules is, you know, deportation. You have to follow these rules. You point out that your job is to break the rules. But I mean, there are rules when it comes to people who have committed a crime, if that is indeed the case here. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, as I said in the video, I'm trying to change the rules, not break the rules. Every week for about a year now, I've been demonstrating outside of the migration office, urging them to stop the deportations to Afghanistan. And I've been working with refugees, making sure that they are not homeless and trying to keep them in school. And we together as activists are trying to change the politics in a way that makes sure that people from Afghanistan that are refugees from Afghanistan gets to stay in Sweden.
Even if they've committed a crime, if that is indeed the case.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't matter your history. You still have the right to live.
So this 52-year-old Afghan was taken off the plane. You at least briefly prevented that man's deportation. Do you know what ultimately happened to him?
No, I have not been reading in newspapers or been on social media to look after what happened to him afterwards. And I have not reached out to him or the other family that was on the airport. I'm just trying to let them have their life without me involving it.
And do you know what happened to Ismail, the 26-year-old Afghan you were hoping to help?
They have driven him across the country from Gothenburg to Stockholm to be put on a plane there and go to Afghanistan.
Yeah, how does that make you feel?
It feels horrible because he has never been to Afghanistan before. He was not born there. And he has no possible way of knowing where to go and how to provide for himself in a country that he has never been to.
You know, anybody who's seen the video at this point will obviously remark on the fact that you are alone in your support of this man. You get a little kind of mild support, maybe some comments in the background, but mostly you're being criticized by a couple of different people on the plane. And then at the end, when they take the man off the plane, there's a big round of applause. And I'm just wondering, that response that you received on the plane that morning, decidedly mixed response, does that tell us anything about Swedish society at large today and how migrant-friendly or unfriendly it is?
Yeah, well, the people who scream the loudest are often the ones that are negative. I could see people who were positive of what I was doing and they supported me and showed me their support, but they didn't come up and actually talk to me. And It might resemble Swedish society, but it might also resemble how people react in bad situations. They want to protect themselves first, and then if someone else stands up, they appreciate that, but they need to protect their own.
Has this experience changed your life?
Yeah, of course. I've been to similar experience stopping deportations before, and each time I feel like I know that the Swedish state is doing something wrong when they're deportating people. I feel like I finally have the space to actually talk about these things in a broader sense, and that people that haven't heard about these issues before finally get to hear about how Sweden are treating refugees.
And what about your own consequences with this? I mean, I know you have a lawyer. Are you worried that you might face legal charges?
Well, I won't comment on that without my lawyer presence.
All right, we'll leave it there. Activist Elin Ersin, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, too.
That was Elin Ersin, a Swedish activist whose video refusal to be seated on a plane went viral last week. As we heard, the man whose deportation Ersin intended to halt, a 26-year-old Afghan, he's been deported from Sweden. As for the older Afghan man who was actually on the plane, the 52-year-old who was reportedly convicted of assault in Sweden, there's still confusion there. Earlier, we asked reporter Maddie Savage in Stockholm for the latest in the older man's case.
Various different Swedish media sources have reported that he has been deported from another part of Sweden, but that has not been confirmed to us by police. This has also come as it has emerged that he is facing a prison sentence in Sweden for assault, according to some Swedish media. Again, this has not been verified to us by the police, and it's not something that's been reported by Swedish public service broadcasters. So it's not totally clear what's happened to him. And I think it's important to point out the context of this. Here in Sweden, suspects are very, very rarely named in the media, and ethnicity isn't something that's logged in relation to crimes. But of course, the significance of all of this, whether he's actually been deported or not, and what the specific details are surrounding these assault allegations, is the fact that she has very much been hailed as a hero by a lot of the left-wing media over the past week or so, somebody standing up for the rights of asylum seekers. But of course, if this is somebody that's been committing crimes in Sweden, that does very much start to shift the debate around his deportation.
How does it change the way the actions of Ilan Ersin are being seen in Sweden and around the world?
There have been a number of right-wing bloggers and people taking to social media already to effectively complain that she shouldn't have been held up as such a hero, and also criticizing various media for not digging into the nitty-gritty of the story. Although, as I've said, it's hard to do that in a climate where police and the Swedish Migration Agency tend to be very tight-lipped about specific cases. And also talking about a bit of a contrast, really, between the Swedish Foreign Office, which gives official travel advice to Swedes, telling them to avoid all travel to Afghanistan due to the security situation. But then the Migration Agency still maintaining that parts of the country, including its capital Kabul, are safe enough for asylum seekers to be returned there. So those are the national debates. And then the even bigger context to all of this is the fact that there is an election coming up in Sweden in just over a month. And immigration and integration, two of the hottest topics here. There have been a number of high-profile crimes carried out by asylum seekers here in Sweden, including hand grenade attacks and shootings. That has very much angered the right here. And so if it is the case that this man was involved in an assault, reports suggesting he was sentenced to 2 years in prison, which means it could have been quite a serious crime, that is going to add a lot of fuel to the right here in Sweden, who want the country to cut down even further on immigration and are very concerned about integration in the future.
So it's fair to say that immigration has become a polarizing issue in Sweden. I'm curious, how controversial in particular is the issue of returning unsuccessful asylum seekers to Afghanistan and facing what some believe is violence and possibly death?
I wouldn't say it's a key issue amongst most of the electorate. I think the key issues for people living here in Sweden are more concerning jobs, whether or not asylum seekers should be forced to learn to speak Swedish, the strain on the welfare state. But on the other hand, there are a lot of activists that have been talking about this issue for some months. There have been a few other protests at different airports around the country because of this discrepancy that they see between Swedes being told they can't go to Afghanistan because it's unsafe and asylum seekers being told they have to go home.
And what impact will this case and the attention brought to it by Ms. Ersin have on other deportations? Likely to slow down the process or the opposite?
What has often happened is that asylum seekers have ended up going underground, and that is something that's also been worrying those on the right here. That's been a key issue. And so a lot of people want to push forward these deportations quickly so that people don't end up taking jobs on the black market and existing in Sweden illegally. So a lot of different issues to discuss in the run-up to the election. But I think what's really fascinating is that we are just looking at a very different story when we were seeing what was being hailed as a humanitarian hero. And now a lot of people are using this as yet another example to suggest that Sweden hasn't handled immigration and integration properly, and that its very open policy in the past is one that can be called into question.
And when are the elections there?
Elections are taking place in about 6 weeks from now, on the 9th of September, and it really is going to be on a bit of a knife edge. It's going to be very difficult for the centre-left or the centre-right to get a majority bloc, and it could leave this anti-immigration party as the kingmakers. So it's going to be very interesting to watch and see whether deportations and immigration become even more of a focal point in the campaign as we get a little bit closer to that crucial vote.
Journalist Maddie Savage speaking with us from the Swedish capital, Stockholm. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. A $15,000 jacket made from ostrich that came out at the start of Paul Manafort's trial Tuesday. Apparently he bought one. I'll leave it to you to imagine what his ostrich coat looks like. But where did Manafort get all of this money? The prosecution points to Kiev. That's why Ukraine has been under the spotlight at today's trial. So how does Ukraine see all of this? Maxim Aristavi is a research fellow with the Atlantic Council. He's in Prague today, but spends a lot of time in Kiev. Maxim, what reaction to the Manafort trial and revelations have you heard coming out of Ukraine? Are people talking about this?
Well, I don't think that people are actually surprised or talk about it much because, may I remind you that the whole affair and the whole scandal originated in Ukraine back in 2015, when we actually saw our first leaks connecting Paul Manafort to ruler of Ukraine, President Yanukovych, and his corrupt regime. So I think, the major mood is just it's about right time for the West to finally came around all these details. We were trying to bring attention and trying to point the international attention since like years ago.
Right. So 2015, this is old news for Kiev. They're just like, what took so long for the trial?
Exactly. Yeah.
Manafort earned more than $60 million doing business in Ukraine. Can you give us some more detail on what his role was in Kiev exactly? Like, what did he do?
Well, obviously, in this specific case, the case that the trial examines, it links it to then now fugitive president of Ukraine, President Yanukovych, and his corrupt regime that was actually maintaining one of the most corrupt regimes in the world. And as we understand, basically, he was providing services to President Yanukovych and his team as a spin doctor and tried to navigate through not only internal but also external terrain for that regime. But unfortunately, you know, we didn't know the scope, the whole scope of that kind of affair and the price tag to it. $60 million. That's probably surprising even for Ukrainians. But at the same time, looking at the scope of the robbery that regime President Yanukovych did to Ukraine, and we're talking about billions of dollars, this is unfortunately not so much.
Yeah, according to a Guardian article, Paul Manafort authorized a so-called secret media operation for Yanukovych aimed at discrediting his key opponent at the time, Yulia Tymoshenko. And there were strategies that included rewriting Wikipedia entries and setting up fake think tanks and social media accounts. And I got to say, it feels reminiscent of what the Kremlin did with its troll farm during the 2016 U.S. elections. Do you see a connection there?
Well, I'm pretty sure you can, see similarities with what is happening in the United States as well at the moment with fake news and disinformation. And that's something, another topic that we were trying to bring international attention since 2014, because Ukraine has been the ground zero for disinformation campaigns launched by Russia. And Paul Manafort obviously had a connection to Russia and was apparently introduced by Russians to President Yanukovych as a spin doctor. So I think that what we've been dealing here since 2013, informational warfare, disinformation, is unfortunately now spreading across the world. And this is something, you know, we've been trying to bring attention, not because we think our story is more important than other global developments, but because we feel like some things originated in countries like Ukraine and now are basically copy-pasted and launched on other democracies like inside European Union and the United States, unfortunately.
Yeah, so was Ukraine a learning moment for the Kremlin? Can you make that connection to, Manafort, the Kremlin, and the Kremlin's desire to not see Hillary Clinton win the election here?
Well, I think one thing is for sure that it was a partial success. Obviously, you know, the Kremlin regime lost Ukraine to a popular pro-democratic, pro-Western uprising. But at the same time, the scale of and devastation that disinformation campaign brought to Ukraine, especially after the invasion of eastern Ukraine, especially after the annexation of Crimea, is just colossal. I think that the impact is not only about the spread of fake news, but the devastation that it brought to families and, you know, rich people's lives. This is something that you can say partial success on behalf of the Kremlin regime. And now it tries to employ probably directly or indirectly the same tactics elsewhere, which is something that I think we, again, can go back to 2012, 2013, look at the example of Ukraine or Georgia or Moldova, the first victims of Russian aggression and maybe pick up some things to learn from it.
Obviously, we'll learn a little more about the business in Ukraine today in court, but what is the bigger picture that comes out of Manafort, Paul Manafort, and his ties to Ukraine? What does it say about Ukraine and the United States?
I think it's less about the United States and Ukraine in a local sense. I think it's the message here is much stronger about this internationalized circles that actually, you know, now much more transborder. And despite that they attack the whole notion of globalization and attack liberal democracies, they actually benefit from this globalization. So they can easily hire people and use foreign firms to justify their illiberal or even autocratic regimes. And I think that changes the whole paradigm, how we see tackling and influencing those undemocratic regimes in the region. It cannot be just a local solution anymore. We got to look to London. We got to look to United States now and find all those links and actually use them and enforce them and maybe severe them in a way to help oppressed people to finally free themselves in those regions.
Maxime Aristavi, a research fellow with the Atlantic Council, he's been speaking with us from Prague. Thanks very much, Maxime.
Thank you for having me.
Geopolitics that leave you with that slightly twitchy sense of unease. Polish trumpeter Tomasz Stanko had written the soundtrack for that feeling when Homeland came calling. This haunting composition by Stanko is called Terminal 7. Tomasz Stanko may be a disciple of Miles Davis, but still not a name you're familiar with. This track might be, though. Terminal 7 was featured regularly in the first season of the Showtime series Homeland, your regular source for uneasy geopolitical drama. And rumor has it Terminal 7 is set to be brought back for what may very well be the final season of Homeland. We wanted to offer you a taste of Terminal 7 today to honor Tomasz Stanko, who died last weekend at the age of 76. He'll be remembered among his musical collaborators as someone who encouraged freedom of expression. The news of his death has been covered widely in Polish media, but perhaps one of the most spot-on descriptions of his legacy came from a German newspaper which called Stanko the Edgar Allan Poe of the trumpet. It's the world. I'm Marco Werman. Plastic guns aren't just toys anymore. That's pretty clear after a court ordered a temporary halt to the release of blueprints for making guns with a 3D printer.
You've got this completely unregulated, private, untraceable weapon with no serial number, and you've essentially circumvented all gun control without breaking any laws.
That story just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. 3D printing allows you to make pretty much anything you want from plastic, if you can figure out how to build it. Last Friday, it became easier to learn how to make plastic guns. The Texas company Defense Distributed published blueprints for how to do that, but a federal judge has now halted publishing. The judge sided with several states that argue that these guns, untraceable weapons, are a threat to public safety. The case isn't over, though. Another hearing is planned for next week. Andy Greenberg is a reporter with Wired. I asked him how this legal fight started.
So in 2013, Defense Distributed, this group that essentially wants to make it possible for anybody in the world to download and create their own gun at home, they released the blueprints for the first 3D printable gun. They called it the Liberator. It was this one-shot plastic pistol. the State Department, this obscure part of the State Department, in fact, that controls the export of weapons from the U.S., they threatened the founder of Defense Distributed, Cody Wilson, with jail time and fines for having essentially exported a weapon by putting the file for this gun on the internet, which reaches all around the world.
Right.
So he took that file down. Defense Distributed stopped sharing those blueprints. But then in 2015, he sued the State Department with an argument that the code for these guns are essentially speech and are protected by the First Amendment.
Have the concerns that the State Department had in 2013 changed?
Well, the State Department, weirdly, in 2018, just rolled over and settled with Defense Distributed and gave them everything they wanted. The State Department settlement actually changed the rules for everyone so that anyone can essentially share technical gun data online and not be subject to these export control rules. But they haven't actually offered a rationale for why they changed their minds about this. Of course, the difference is that in 2018, the State Department is run by the Trump administration instead of the Obama administration.
How many different types of guns can be made with Defense Distributed's digital blueprints?
Well, they actually had for several days posted all of their gun files online before this new lawsuit from the attorneys general. So all that stuff was out there for days and downloaded thousands of times. And those files included not only the blueprint for the fully 3D printed gun they call the Liberator, this one-shot pistol. They also included all of the components for weapons like an AR-15 semi-automatic rifle, an AR-10, a Beretta M9 handgun. These are guns that probably can't be fully 3D printed in a practical way yet, at least. But you can print the frame of the gun, the lower receiver, they call it, which is actually the only part of the gun under U.S. regulations that is actually controlled at all. And then everything else you can just buy off the internet. You can use Bitcoin to protect your identity if you want. And then you assemble it at home and you've got this completely unregulated, private, untraceable weapon with no serial number, and you've essentially circumvented all gun control without breaking any laws.
Do you have any sense, Andy, of how many guns have been produced out in the world based on gun designs that have been uploaded for 3D printing?
Well, in 2013, that file was downloaded more than 100,000 times. And then more recently, there have been thousands of downloads of these new files. We don't know how many times those files were actually printed or turned into working weapons. That's kind of the whole idea, is that when you do this, you circumvent all regulation or oversight or any way for anybody but you to know that you've created this gun.
One of the big concerns the attorneys general have cited is the impact that these blueprints could have internationally, especially on terrorism. Does the evidence bear that concern out?
No, I'm not sure I really see that argument. I do see how this attempt to essentially eviscerate gun control worldwide would matter, especially in countries that have much stronger gun control than the U.S., the U.K., Europe, even countries like Russia and China that make it almost impossible to own guns. They probably even more than the U.S. must see this as a practical threat.
Where do the gun manufacturers and the NRA stand on this?
I think that NRA members like the notion of perfect privacy from law enforcement and gun regulators, that you can have a totally untraceable and private weapon. At the same time, the NRA is largely supported by the gun industry. You know, they don't want to help people make guns at home. They want to sell guns. So it seems like mostly the NRA has stayed out of this issue. Now that it's really percolating to the surface with all of these lawmakers and politicians starting to talk about it, I think we're going to see the NRA take a stand. But I'm not sure myself what it's going to be yet.
So, Andy, let's get back to where all this started. Defense Distributed in Austin, Texas. You actually visited there and you spoke with the founder, Cody Wilson. He's a self-declared anarchist. Has this whole thing become like an ideological mission for Cody Wilson?
I think it was an ideological mission from the very beginning. And Cody Wilson for years has been telling me that this is not just about guns. It certainly is about guns. And he wants everyone in the world to be able to access and own guns. I mean, really everyone. But he also sees this as a kind of representation of a larger point he wants to make, which is that in this new era of technology, the government has been rendered almost obsolete. He is a radical libertarian, and he believes that the internet and these kinds of tools just fundamentally undermine the ability of law to govern people.
And he likes that.
He sees himself as a kind of prophet that is ushering in this new era. I first spoke to him in 2012 when he first declared that he was going to make the world's first 3D printed gun. And then a year later, he pulled it off. And then ever since then, he's been advancing this mission with computer controlled milling machines to make it possible to make fully metal guns. And I'm sure he's not going to stop. And he's also simultaneously fighting these legal battles. you know, he is a very prolific advocate and accelerator of this kind of scary evolution.
Andy Greenberg, a reporter for Wired magazine, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Handguns are very common in the U.S., of course. In Russia, they're illegal, but Maria Butina tried to change that. You know that name. Butina is the 29-year-old Russian woman currently accused of acting as a foreign agent in Washington. Long before she became front-page news, Butina tried to set up a gun lobby in Russia, similar to the NRA. She was just 22 at the time.
She really came out of the blue in 2011 and managed to galvanize, you know, a group of activists together to form this new movement called Right to Bear Arms.
Carl Schreck is a senior correspondent with Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty.
They very quickly built a relatively large public profile by staging street rallies in favor of legalization of handguns. They managed to get cooperation from some parliamentarians and some supporters across the Russian political spectrum. But even people who worked with Putin at the beginning with this gun rights movement said they were skeptical at first, but that she managed to bring this issue, if not to the top of the Russian political agenda, she at least brought some nationwide attention.
I mean, what's kind of surprising, maybe most surprising, is that she became such a significant player in the gun rights movement in Russia when she was so young. She was only 22 when this started, right?
Correct. And even those close, you know, who worked with her in this movement at the time, they were all under the impression that the organization was being financed by the revenues from the sale of some furniture companies that she ran. Although there were observers, including some in the Russian opposition, who told me that it was very clear that they had some decent financing behind them. Their merch at their rallies was quite good. Their technical capabilities were quite good, which was surprising for a small new group. So people told me that it was clear there was some money behind them.
Well, we now know that Maria Butina's narrative as an agent of influence on U.S. soil, it's about duplicity. So having done a deep dive into her background, Carl, how legitimate is Maria Butina's interest in guns and gun rights? Is she someone's creation, or does she sincerely believe in liberalizing gun ownership in Russia?
It's an interesting question. People who worked with her say she indeed was very passionate about this issue. What her true intentions were, can't really speculate on that. But, you know, once it emerged that she had some relatively good connections, and I'm speaking about Alexander Torshin, who's a close associate of hers, a mentor of hers, and he was a Russian parliamentarian at the time. You know, and he had been advocating for loosening of gun laws in Russia. And once people in the gun rights community learned that Butina had connections with Mr. Torshin, there was a little burst of enthusiasm that there may be some actual movement on this issue.
So are you saying that Butina's rapid rise in the gun rights movement was due to her Kremlin connections? I mean, do we know which came first? Like, is this a chicken or egg thing?
Obviously, Mr. Torshin is very much ensconced in Russia's ruling business and political elite. He was a parliamentarian at the time and is now a senior official in Russia's central bank. You know, I can't speak to specifically what ties he has with President Putin, for example, but certainly it was a big boost to her credibility in the gun rights movement that she had this very high-level connection.
Is Torshin the Russian named in the indictment?
I don't believe he's named in the indictment, but it appears almost certainly to be him.
So, Carl, what do we know about how Vladimir Putin feels about liberalizing firearms in Russia today? Because a few years ago, he seemed dead set against that. And I'm just curious how you square his opposition to guns with this alleged Russian spy, Butina, who is all about guns.
Right. The Russian leadership has long been opposed to loosening gun laws. Most recently, I believe it was late last year, sometime last year, you know, a top Putin associate said that this is not something that is good for Russia. And in general, whatever the enthusiasm that activists felt when they learned that they had a supporter in Mr. Torshin, you know, it was widely seen as an issue that was never really going to get anywhere in Russia. And certainly since Butina stepped down as the head of this group, and it has kind of receded from, public rallies and things like that. The optimism among the gun rights community in Russia that there will be any movement on this issue is not very great.
That's Carl Schreck with Radio Free Europe in Prague. Tens of thousands of supporters have staged Free Tommy protests in the UK. Here in the US, Steve Bannon and Donald Trump Jr. have come to Tommy's defense. Tommy is Tommy Robinson. He was once a fringe player on the UK's radical right, but then he was sentenced to 13 months in prison in May after live streaming outside a courthouse. That's the crime, disrupting the courts. Robinson was also spewing racism. That's the content. Today, Robinson was freed on bail while his case is being appealed. My BBC colleague Dominic Casciani has been covering the case from London. So for our audience here in the US, tell us who Tommy Robinson is.
Well, a lot of people in the UK don't actually know who Tommy Robinson is. He's rather split opinions down the years. Tommy Robinson first came to prominence in the UK in 2009 when he became the head of what's best described as a far-right street movement called the English Defence League. Now, this was drawn from football supporters who were involved in hooliganism, violence, effectively people who just wanted to go to football matches, soccer matches in the UK to basically have a fight. Those people came together around him as part of a protest movement he was trying to build against what he saw as what he called radical Islam in the UK. And he built this street movement to effectively combat this. Now, nobody took a great deal of notice of his movements at the time, but all of a sudden he was getting thousands of young men onto the streets to protest, and he started to rise in prominence. And largely, that prominence was built online, and he effectively developed a persona as effectively a new leader of the far right in the UK, and his influence has been growing ever since.
So what exactly is Tommy Robinson accused of doing?
This is really complex, and it's been massively misreported and misquoted. So let me break this down, right? Now, we have a very strange concept in the UK, or rather strange to American audiences, which is called contempt of court. When somebody goes on trial, on criminal trial in the UK, we reporters, we have to report very factually what has happened, as do your reporters. But the whole idea of comment and discussion about the court case can't happen until there's been a final verdict from the jury. Now, in the case of Tommy Robinson, he was accused of basically flouting that law by basically giving his opinion by turning up at courts and recording videos which went onto Facebook. Now, he was charged with that offence and given a 13-month jail sentence.
How did this whole Free Tommy Robinson movement start?
This Free Tommy Robinson movement has started because of this perception that his free speech has been curtailed, that there's been some kind of push by the state, by the government, by the police to silence Tommy Robinson. What the Court of Appeal here in London said today, which is one of our highest courts, is this wasn't about free speech. Nobody's saying he can't have his say. He can have his say when the cases he was trying to influence come to an end. What this was about was him not following the basic rules of how English courts work. But that Free Tommy Robinson movement has been growing like wildfire across the net. So a few years ago, he looked like a busted flush. He looked like he was basically gone and forgotten when his original street movement started to die. Today, he's got about 800,000 followers on his official Facebook page, 250,000 followers on YouTube. Critically, have a look at what's happened in the United States. Steve Bannon has come out in support of him. I mean, he was on radio here in London last week saying that he thought that Tommy was not a bad guy. He should be out of prison. He's got the following of far-right leaders in parts of Europe. He's been one of the prominent commentators on a Canadian media outfit called Rebel Media, which is part of the alt-right. So he's been expanding his influence. And anti-racism campaigners here in London believe that a lot of the alt-right in America are effectively trying to use Tommy Robinson's notoriety to expand and push their arguments into European politics.
The BBC's Dominic Casciani in London, thanks very much for telling us about far right-wing activist Tommy Robinson. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Here in the U.S., it's called upskirting. You know, when some creepy guy takes a smartphone photo up a woman's skirt. In South Korea, it's got another name, molka.
So molka is actually a abbreviated version of mole camera. Mole meaning secret or hidden, and camera in English. So something as spy cam or hidden camera.
That's Minji Lee of the BBC's Korean service. She says molka gets creepier and goes beyond smartphone cameras on a subway platform. It also involves using tiny spy cams in public bathroom.
If you go to some buildings in Korea, you would strangely notice that on the wall, there would be random small holes. And behind those holes, a person in the stall next to you would be hiding a camera and be in that stall filming you. Or in other cases, they would hide it in plastic cups and place it on top of the toilets.
Lee says it's become so common that women try to hide their faces in bathrooms so they can't be identified if someone posts their picture online. Mulca is illegal, but critics say most cases go unpunished.
When women take the case to the police, what the police requires them is to have evidence. But in most cases, it's very hard for women to actually have evidence. And it's also traumatic for them to go into those illegal sites, see random men commenting on their body and report to the police.
In June, more than 20,000 women took to the streets in Seoul demanding action. Some carried signs that read, "My life is not your porn." It was reportedly one of the largest women's protests ever in South Korea. It's been a summer of heat, political and social challenges, and viral trends. One trend you may have spotted involves remixing a song, not just a song, but also the video for the song, and a year's worth of social critique to say something about a country and its politics. The World's Brandy Fullwood picks it up from there.
Childish Gambino, a.k.a. Donald Glover, got a lot of attention when he released This Is America a few months ago. The video is a social and political critique of America, and it sparked its own series of critiques and conversations online and IRL, or in real life. The basic premise is this: police brutality, guns, and a history of violence experienced by Black Americans. The video is intermixed with dance routines that have gone viral, and a thesis that a cycle of entertainment and news is ever present. This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now. Look what I'm whipping now. This is America. It's repetitive, it's catchy, and it's all set to eerie horror movie-inspired trap music. It's definitely danceable, but at the same time, it's sinister. And it also started something big. Gambino's This Is America sparked a global wave. This is Nigeria. There's plenty of halasha. Fulani heads, man, still a slaughter. Got it, people, they massacre. Since May, This Is France, This Is Ghana, This Is Korea, This Is Malaysia, This Is South Africa, and many more have come out.
Yeah, there's been a lot of remakes. This Is Nigeria was actually probably my favorite out of all of them. Like, I didn't know the kind of social problems they're having and sort of issues that that country is facing. And it just shed a lot of light on that, which was quite interesting, actually.
That's Majid, a rapper who goes by the name INZ. He was born in Scotland, grew up in New Zealand, and his family is from Iraq. And he raps in this new video remix, This Is Iraq.
Okay, so actually the minute that I heard This Is America, I had to make it for Iraq. You know, I feel like every remake to each country sort of highlights problems within that country. We just want freedom, keep
asking the bay. This is not a party. The video opens with two men on a carpet. One's playing an oud and the other is watching in awe and interest. And then you see these two soldiers in the background doing those dances that made the army go viral. And then... This is Iraq. Yeah. Look at us blowing up. Nobody showing up. Nobody owing up. هذا العراق. بدايتك آخرتك. جوازك آخرتك. وين جوازك؟ بس دير بالك لك لا تغلط.
This is Iraq. Well, for me, that just sort of represents the transition from sort of what was old and beautiful to sort of what's like new and not so great, you know?
The video takes place during the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq, a war, Majid says, many people have forgotten or otherwise are still unclear about it.
Well, no, that's the thing. I mean, I've had a lot of people actually reach out to me and say, you know what, when the invasion happened, we were too young to know what was going on.
Majid says that the video isn't all watch and learn, but that so many watch it and research it on their own afterwards. So 2003, that's like 15 years ago. Why start there?
I think it was a very controversial moment in sort of, I mean, look, Iraq's past is riddled in controversy, really. But for me, you know, that war should have never happened.
American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq.
The attack came in waves, cruise missiles, followed by the F-117 stealth bombers with so-called bunker-busting bombs.
These are opening stages of what will be a broad and concerted campaign.
The director, actors, and Majid wanted to write from an empathetic place.
You know, when we had the discussion with the director, we came to the conclusion that we wanted to sort of pull out or bring out all the sort of iconic imagery of the war. So, of course, some of the most iconic images are that of the Abu Ghraib prison and what had happened there. And then, of course, the oil. You can't talk about Iraq without highlighting oil, right?
And like the Gambino video, there's a lot going on. Guns, terrorist groups, kidnapping, drug abuse, selfies with prisoners, and a lot of blood.
The price of blood is apparently very cheap in Iraq.
The video spans a history of time that is most important to the argument and critique. For Majid, that's a lot of senseless violence that has led to a ton of devastating consequences in Iraq. And unfortunately, it's not enough to turn heads.
I just felt that people have become a bit too desensitized to what's going on in the region. And I just thought that, you know, the fact that the original track had gone so popular and gone so viral that it presented the perfect opportunity to use that platform to then sort of shed light on the situation in Iraq, you know, just remind people what has happened over the past 15 years and what's still currently ongoing.
For The World, I'm Brandi Fulwood.
This is Iraq. Look at us blowing up. Look how I'm throwing up. Prime Minister on the up. Yeah, this is Iraq. Corrupting the area. Voicing hysteria. Saying we gon' take care of ya.
Brandi's story is part of Future Folk, our partnership with Smithsonian Folkways. You can check out This is Iraq and 14 other videos modeled after Childish Gambino's This is America. That's over at PRI.org. That's where we leave things today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you all tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.